This is an ABC podcast.
I'm Jonathan Green. This is Lost and Found, and this week we're off to Vienna. Today, the Austrian capital, it's widely known as the world's most livable city. I'm sorry, Melbourne, but there it is. But in the cosy domesticity of that term, livable, there's no hint there of the drama of Vienna's cultural past. Now, once upon a time, Vienna was home to some of history's greatest artists, philosophers, composers, from Klimt to Schoenberg to Freud. Now, Freud felt profound ambivalence about the city, which he called home for nearly 80 years. Having written of his disgust at the oppressive city, he was in the end reluctant to leave. Once in exile in London, he described his liberation as tinged, quote, with mourning, for I still very much love the prison from which I had been released. In the 19th and early 20th century, Freud's prison was both an old imperial capital and the beating heart of modern culture. It was the place preoccupied by the inner life of man, by madness, by sex, and by death. And who better to guide me through the city that shaped so much of 20th century intellectual life in Europe than Juliana Engberg, curator, author of En Route. Juliana, here we are. I feel either in need of coffee or psychoanalysis, and I think I'm in the right place.
I can do both of those things for you, Jonathan. How clever of you to know. Because just because it's near the hotel, I think the first place we'll pop into is the Café Central.
Excellent.
Of course, famously visited by Trotsky, by Freud, by all of the people plotting all of the plots that were going to undo the grandeur and the wonderfulness of the epoch. This is a great historical place, recently renovated and restored to its, you know, perfect glory. And look at it. I mean, wow. It is magnificent. Coffee houses, you know, they were palaces. It was not just a little place to go and nip in and take your takeout.
Now, why is that? What's the sort of social movement behind that as a sort of preferred meeting point?
Well, I dare to say that men mostly gathered in these places to while away the time. Mm. Of course, it was chilly, you know, in people's apartments. So these palaces of coffee really became everyone's living room, and everyone would pick up a paper, that was very important, freely provided, and you could just while away the time or write your novel, as many people did, or converse with the people, wonder if in fact Mr. Trotsky would overturn, you know, the regime, etc., which of course he tried to do. And so it was a melting pot of intelligentsia. Ideas flourished there, and of course if you went in on any day, you were very likely to bump into some of the great notable names of history. Especially those people creating a Vienna that was a hotbed of the emergence of psychoanalysis and very strongly debated ideas of emergent communism, etc. So in this lush, extravagantly decorated, beautifully, you know, ornamental kind of place, you have this kind of desire for the mundane, the even, the equality, all of those things that would erase the grandeur.
That impulse to strip back, to turn away from high emotionality, ornateness and grandeur, it was everywhere apparent in turn-of-the-century Vienna. The second Viennese school, Arnold Schoenberg and his pupils Anton Webern and Alban Berg, provided a somewhat dissonant expression of this radical cultural moment.
They were self-styled the second Viennese school.
Andrew Ford.
At the first Viennese school having been Haydn, Mozart and Beethoven. So they were throwing down the gauntlet somewhat, and they are of huge historical importance. We heard that song Die Nachtigall from Berg's seven early songs. That's 1907. Mm. And that's a setting of a poem by Theodor Storm. It's a 19th century poem. There's a lot of romanticism in that music, clearly. a lot of old-fashioned Viennese schmaltz even, but it doesn't last, or it doesn't last in that form, because what is about to happen, even as the Habsburg Empire crumbles, is that tonality crumbles, that the system of keys which had supported music for, well, a few hundred years at least, in Schoenberg's hands, comes to an end. He didn't arbitrarily decide to do this. Musical tonality had been increasingly stretched under composers such as Wagner in particular, and Mahler and Bruckner. But with Schoenberg, it snaps, and we go from having a very stretched sense of tonality to no tonality at all, to atonality or non-tonality. And it happens in his second string quartet, which is actually written the year after Berg wrote that song that we heard. And the second string quartet is in four movements, one of which quotes "O du lieber Augustin," you know, the "O du lieber Augustin, Augustin, Augustin," that "Alles ist hin," everything's lost. And what's lost here eventually is tonality itself. And in the final movement, there's no key signature because there is no key. And the extraordinary thing that happens in this string quartet is that a soprano voice appears. We don't normally get sopranos in string quartets. And she's singing words by Stefan Georg, the expressionist poet and playwright. And his words are, "Ich fühle Luft von anderen Planeten," I feel the air from another planet. She's actually providing the commentary on what's happening in the music.
Of course, another planet might sound decidedly destabilising for some visitors. The timorous among you for whom modernism's radical doubt and epistemological upheaval is likely to produce, well, vertigo. Mr. Wizard, fear not. There's plenty of imperial solidity to be found in the Austrian capital. Colin Bissett.
A tram ride along Ringstrasse is the perfect way to appreciate the 19th century buildings of Imperial Vienna. The Habsburgs' wealth is apparent also in their palaces and formal gardens. But many miss a particular gem, the Irmes Villa, which is set in the old royal hunting grounds on the outskirts of the city. So if you fancy some fresh air, take tram 62 to the Lainzer Tiergarten and then stroll through the beautiful wooded parkland to the villa. It's a strange place, the work of Karl von Heisenauer, whose neo-baroque Burg Theatre you might have passed on the Ringstrasse. It was the gift given in 1886 by the Emperor Franz Joseph to his wife Elizabeth, known as Sissi, who called it her Palace of Dreams. Its proper name comes from the dominant statue of the Greek god Hermes in its garden. Now open to the public, it's a perfect example of what was considered stylish in 19th century Vienna, being such a jumble of everything. There's a Dutch gable here, a French Renaissance roof there, and baronial turrets worthy of any Bavarian castle. The whole thing somehow held together by brickwork, mostly laid in a crisscross pattern, just to jazz everything up. The garden verandas drip with enough iron lace to shame the grandest Melbourne home. It's the sort of lavish country pile that American tycoons emulated with their summer retreats at the same time. Inside, every surface is decorated with lavishly painted ceilings, gilded columns and intricate parquetry floors. But while its ostentation is fun, in a way, the place is suffused with the sadness of the woman for whom it was built. Sissi was a lost soul, obsessed by her appearance, and who loathed the starchy formality of the Habsburg court. This was to be a place where she could retreat and relax. But only a few years later, in 1889, her son, the Crown Prince, committed suicide at Meierling, along with his mistress. Sissi's already precarious mental health never recovered, and she diverted herself by travelling almost continuously. In 1898, the Empress was stabbed and killed by an Italian anarchist as she strolled beside Lake Geneva. Her story adds piquancy to a building already brimful with curiosities.
And from piquancy to austerity, Juliana, where are you taking us now?
I think now that we've had our fantastic strudel and our coffee and we're sort of buoyed for the day, we can stroll quite a bit in Vienna. It is a lovely...
Strolling's a thing?
It's a walking city. It's also, of course, as all clever cities are that have them, still kept its trams, and they snake around the city, and it's a very beautiful way to travel. But really where we're going this morning is on foot, and we're heading right on down to a crucible of emergent artistic endeavour, talent, the Secession, a wonderful little building. It looks a bit like a Masonic lodge, maybe.
Masonic lodge, yes.
Yeah, but with a little bit more decorative flair. We see that dome of golden laurel leaves that have come together as a kind of globe, sitting there on the top, announcing that something rather fabulous may be inside
and
this rather austere
A very
exterior.
Austere, one might almost say blank as a facade.
Quite. I mean, what you see in the Secession building is the emergence of a trend towards simplicity. Famously, of course, you know, Adolf Loos, who was, you know, Austrian, really discarded or wished to erase the ornament, which had become very much a part of that flamboyant previous era. So he was part of a group of people who wanted to cleanse things, architecture in particular.
But this building's almost sort of ostentatiously cleansed.
It's very purposeful in its severity because it's announcing a kind of manifesto. However, the Secession artists themselves never produced a manifesto. They were a various group. Perhaps the best known of them, however, would be Gustav Klimt. Klimt came together with other artists to celebrate the work of Beethoven. And so this mural that you see around us, Jonathan,
that is awesome.
It is an awesome piece of art. Of course, it has the Klimtian elements of gold leaf, etc., and those curious, almost stylized bodies that he has in his paintings.
None of his characteristic cheesiness, shall
no.
we say.
No, there is a sort of peculiar corporality of his characters. They're not comfortable people to look at. There's often something very macabre or sinister going on. And in particular, I would draw your attention to the middle panel, where you see this extraordinary ape-like figure, who is in fact a sort of demon god, who is drawing lust and wantonness and all sorts of bad, you know, karmas toward him. This middle passage represents this dark passage that people have to go through as they mature. On either side of this very dark spot, we have this lighter movement of figures coming in and going out and eventually turning into harmony. And so Klimt is trying to represent in some way Beethoven's own motifs, and in particular, if we think of the Symphony No. 9, which Ode to Joy, we have this last moment of a kiss to the world, and we see in the Klimt mosaic that kiss.
But what an extraordinary
panel.
Setting of that piece too. I mean, above head height in that lofted room.
Positioned there retrospectively somewhat. The Secession has been rebuilt, resurrected, and we can now see the full flourishing of Klimt's idea coming together with the architecture in which it was first situated.
The upheavals taking place in the world of Vienna's fine art and architecture reflected a dizzying, disorienting cultural atmosphere. To quote Karl Marx, all that is solid melts into air. Now, nowhere was this radical unmooring more apparent than in the moment music becomes non-tonal.
Now we've got something akin to musical anarchy.
Andrew Ford.
Because the system of keys had anchored music. You knew when the piece was over because we returned to the home key, but we haven't got a home key. You can't even really tell where the music is, where it's going. So you've got a problem here. It's some people have said that in addition to the obvious Freudian connotations, that there are also important connotations in terms of physics, because, of course, this is also the age of Einstein. And in a way, you could say that tonal music is Newtonian. you know, it's about gravity. It's about the pull of the home key. And that atonal music is 12 notes related only to each other. Everything is relative to everything else. And Webern, whose music we haven't heard yet, was the first composer to start to systematize the music. A new system was required. And what you end up with is the 12-tone system. Because if you want a piece to be genuinely atonal, you need to hear every note about the same number of times, so that no one note can dominate. That's the theory. And you hear this in Webern's Symphony of 1927-28. But what you hear in this, apart from the fragmentation of the melodic line, there is still that Viennese schmaltz. There is still the sighing phrase, that the element of musical Sehnsucht.
That pull of tradition, that the longing for the solidity of the past, for familiar references, is not simply the preserve of Vienna's modernist composers.
When my mother and father came, and when I was a child, all I ever heard about was working at the best rye bread and some good sausages and some good quality veal rather than mutton.
Rob Hagen is the son of Austrian migrants who, having arrived in Australia, longed for the taste of Vienna. He's owner of Bierkeller Restaurant in Richmond in Melbourne, and he is, yes, a schnitzel connoisseur.
A Viennese schnitzel is quite different to other schnitzels that are around.
Describe that to me.
Okay, for a start, it has to be veal, even though in Austria they actually eat a lot of pork schnitzel, but actually Viennese schnitzel has to be made from veal. It needs to be crumbed freshly. We like to get a light, crisp crust on the schnitzel and a little bit of air pockets so the crumb lifts off the meat.
Okay, so how do you get that air beneath the crumb? Give away a trade secret here.
Okay, well, freshness is number one, and doing it to order. There is a little trick which I found. If you have the veal comes in different grades these days, some can be a little bit dry. So if you put a tiny bit of moisten the meat a little bit before you crumb it, then you end up getting extra pockets. So that's it.
There you go, you heard it first. Once we move away from the veal and the schnitzel, what else might I find that'll surprise me?
I think what's exciting is there's a thing called a fiaka goulash. So you've got goulash, which traditionally is a Hungarian dish.
Austro-Hungarian, here we go.
Yep, so they've come across and the Viennese have modified it. Now, the fiaka are the horse and carriage, the coachman, if you like, and the coaches. So they're the fiaka. So I guess it's like our cab these days, the cabbie meals. So what they did, they modified the goulash. That was their favourite food, so they called it a fiaka goulash. And the difference is there's usually no vegetables in it. They put extra, it's more onion in the recipe, and they serve it with a sausage, a fried egg, and some pickles as well.
So, oh, wow. So that's a full sort of ploughman's lunch kind of.
Yeah, ploughman's lunch, but yeah, coachman's meal. So yeah, and that's what they had back then. So it's a take on a Hungarian dish, but it's all through Vienna.
Talk to me about cake.
Okay, cake. Well, obviously we have apple strudel. It's very popular throughout the ages. The humble croissant was said to be invented by an Austrian, actually in Paris. The Sachertorte, which came from the Hotel Sacher, is very famous worldwide, which is a chocolate cake with apricot jam and their own sort of recipe. But other than that, they have a lot of fruit cakes as well, like a simple, when the fruits are in season, they love to put sugar on them and bake them in a flat type of cake. And then they just, you know, poppy seeds are another ingredient they like to use.
Of course,
in their,
yes,
sweets. They even use dumplings. They toss in butter and sugar and poppy seed. Yeah, so they like their sweets.
If they like their sweets, as do I, am I ready for more strudel, Juliana?
Strudel you will have, most certainly. Now, this morning, Jonathan, we went to the Café Central.
We did.
But we'll spend a bit of time at the Café Prückel. Now, the Café Prückel is famous, I think, for a few things. The first is the famously grumpy waiters. Now, the famously grumpy waiters of the Café Prückel ignored entirely the edict that went out some time ago when it was discovered that Austrians were considered unfriendly. So the local government, made a plan to actually try and make everyone seem much more accommodating and welcoming to foreigners. The Café Prückel staff said, we'll have nine of that, thank you very much. So they remain completely and utterly curmudgeonly, which is great. great. I want you to observe the hilarious decor of this place. Mm. If the Café Central was extravagantly ornate, here we have a much more at-home feel. The pink and white wallpapering, the odds and sods that seem to have come in wood-based, indicate the way in which Austrian design sort of headed. Much more austere, much more fundamental, much more functional. But it is a great living room to just hang out in. And, of course, it is especially a haunt of artists and other creatives. It is the Café Central of our times. I think, you know, you get a vibe from the Café Prucal, which is much more 68. You know, another form of revolutioning.
Yes.
You know, where the next crop of intellectuals, the next crop of people who wanted to overturn epochs and ideas really gathered in groups. And especially during that time when, you know, Vienna was sectioned off and bits and pieces of it belonged to America, to Britain, to Russia and so forth. This was a gathering point, a meeting place for the young people who really wanted to actually reattach themselves to a world intact.
And if radical Vienna is your thing, you need look no further than Karl Marxhof, perhaps the city's most powerful example of socialist utopian architecture and an enduring statement in a city that many argue has the finest social housing program in Europe. Colin Bissett.
Away from the rococo splendour of Schönbrunn, the Habsburgs' summer home until the empire fell in 1918, there's another building of equal monumentality tucked away in a peaceful neighbourhood, the Karl Marxhof, built in the late 1920s. Sometimes called the Palace of the Proletariat, it's a symbol of the city in its socialist heyday, known as Red Vienna, which ran until 1934, and which social housing and services were its central focus. Take a tram up to Heiligenstadt, but don't worry about missing your stop, because this building is over 1 kilometre long. From the tree-lined road, it looks simple enough, a wall of low-rise apartments, a run of shops. But its centrepiece, set back from the road, is breathtaking, a row of stylized Art Deco towers rising from elegant arched gateways. The name Karl Marxhof is spelled out in simple lettering, and metal statues represent the Marxist aspirations of health, education and freedom. This heroic line of building links the two major parts of the development, each built around a large courtyard filled with trees, lawns and playgrounds. Only a fifth of the entire site is built on, and yet this development was designed to house 5,000 people. Although the apartments were Spartan, there was an abundance of communal facilities, such as a washhouse that's now a museum dedicated to the history of the Red Vienna period. This was a hugely influential building, inspiring less successful versions in Britain and America. Its creator, Karl Ehn, was the city's chief architect, a protege of Otto Wagner, although this building is also inspired by the work of another Viennese architect, Adolf Loos, who famously called ornament a crime, and whose buildings of some 20 years earlier caused a scandal due to their simplicity. Karl Marxhof has flair, though, like a 1930s castle, which is why anti-fascist activists in the 1934 uprising chose to barricade themselves there before being pounded into submission by military forces careless of who they killed in the effort. The building's name was removed during the Nazi occupation, but reinstated after the war. It remains a symbol of different times, and a showpiece of successful, large-scale public housing.
Colin, thank you. Shall we dance? You've been listening to Lost and Found, this week in Vienna. You heard Juliana Engberg, curator and author of En Route, Andrew Ford, presenter of Radio National's The Music Show, Colin Bissett, design writer, and Rob Hagen, chef and owner of Beer Keller Richmond. Producers, Mira Adler-Gillies and Lisa DeVisi. Technical production, Brendan O'Neill. I'm Jonathan Green.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listener.